This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Hi, I'm Tiana.
And I'm Ryan.
And we're from Arcata, California. The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like you and me. If you'd like to donate to support the show, visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, I'm Jesse Thorne, and this is The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.
Radio sweetheart on the airways, it's the sound of young America.
The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. My guests on the program are Mick Collins and Ben Blackwell. They are the frontman and one of the two drummers, respectively, of the band The Dirt Bombs. Their brand new record is called We Have You Surrounded. They're stalwarts of the Detroit rock and roll scene for the past 15 years. And Mick is actually a stalwart of the Detroit rock and roll scene for some 25 years at this point, something like that anyway. Gentlemen, welcome to the Sound of Young America.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you. So I feel like I don't have any understanding of what Detroit is like as a place. Reading about your band and your careers, it's so embedded in Detroit.
Yeah, it's difficult.
How do you explain what it is to somebody who doesn't know?
Well, imagine a company town that doesn't have a company anymore, but all the employees are still there, and that's a succinct description of Detroit.
Well, nothing's coming. Take its place. Company, no other smaller collection of smaller companies, nothing.
There's something in Detroit that, as a native San Franciscan, just absolutely boggled my mind when I was talking with a friend from Detroit about it, which is vacant real estate. Real estate
lots
that's not just vacant because it's between people occupying it, but its state is vacant for an indeterminate period into the future.
Oh, yes.
Definitely.
Yeah, there's entire blocks like that. Huge industrial complexes. In fact, we briefly had a rehearsal space inside one that was thousands and thousands and thousands of square feet.
I think it actually crossed into millions of square feet where we rehearsed.
It was enormous.
Renting out one little room at a time.
They're just renting out to people. One of the nice things about it, though, is that the cost of living in Detroit is so low that if you're an artist, for example, you can just get a place to live and not have to worry about getting turfed, you know, because you don't have any money. Because the cost of living is really low, you can actually do your work and not have to, you know, like, and live like a human being.
Yeah, it's kind of easier to get by, you know, some type of hustle, you know.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding, you know. When you're not doing the band, you pick up things here and there. You know, you work at the record store.
Yeah, you can just do stuff without having to worry. I mean, it's not like it just seems like there are so many artists in New York, and they're all working like four jobs, and they're staying in a place with five other people, and they're still paying $1,200 a month. Or like San Francisco was like that, and you know, there's places, and like in Detroit, what you're paying will buy you a really nice house, you know, and feed you like a king, and you can still not, you know, you only have the one thing to do.
Have you always felt that way about Detroit? Was there a time when you were, you know, a teenager and you dreamed about a different style of life and, you know, I guess whatever the then equivalent of, you know, living in Brooklyn is now?
Well, I think it's weird. You know, Mick and I, you know, we're separated by about maybe 20 years or so in age. And we grew up in different sides of town and different neighborhoods and different kind of upbringings. But I think for the most part, the experience is fairly similar,
yeah.
You know, as far as realizing early on you want to do music And once that became viable and not really having to do anything else doing it, but in regards to the city, it's...
Yeah, just sort of work around it. You know, this the living in Detroit lets you make a decision like, oh, I'm going to be in a band, and that's pretty much all I'm going to do, and you can do it. I think, to answer your question, though, I think every time we tour a lot, we've been touring quite, pretty extensively lately, and every time I go to another city, it seems like, you know, you can't help but compare the two, and yeah, it's pretty frustrating. Yeah, you know, like there's always, you know, there's always more somewhere else, but one of the things that I like about Detroit is that it is, for the most part, quiet like that, where, you know, you're not under pressure to always be on or be somewhere. You know, you can just sort of kick back and relax. You know, we do occasionally play the small town where we're the only thing happening that week. You know, like we know that we're the only thing that there is to do in that town. And some days Detroit feels like that, where there's really only one, there's, you know, you don't have a huge range of options for entertainment. But, you know, when you've been on tour for 2 months, you don't want anything. You just want to sit in your underwear and watch television.
I read an interview in which you, Mick, described that part of being a musician in Detroit for that reason was being in a bunch of different bands and playing a bunch of different kinds of music.
Yeah, when I first started, I hung out my professional music shingle in 1980. And when I first started making, you know, records and talking to people and like recording and all that sort of thing, you know, it seemed like everyone in town played in a bunch of different bands. That was just the way it was. It seemed like everybody had at least two or three bands that they played in. And, you know, everybody talks about side project stuff. Well, nobody thought of them as side projects. They were just what you did. You know, we never even used the term side project. You know, for even if you had like four bands, five bands you played in, none of them were a side project. It was just another band. So, yeah, I mean, it was like that. It's less like that now.
Well, it's gotten to a point where you have, I think for a lot of people, it's you have your band that makes money.
Yeah. And then you have the band that you want to do.
Yeah.
you have the band that you play in, and then the band that you're the front man in.
Yeah, exactly.
that's everybody now.
Mick, I can only imagine that hanging up your professional music shingle in 1980 as a black guy in Detroit, it must have been a pretty conscious choice to be a rock and roll musician.
Nah. See, that question gets asked a lot, too, and it wasn't really. It was... You know, the way I normally put it is, I'm not the only black guy who was in a punk rock band in Detroit in the early 80s. I'm just the only one who's still in one 20 years later.
but at the same time, not being the only one and everyone doing it, there's a big gap in between those two, I think you have to admit.
Well, yeah, but I was, you know, there were a lot of other black folks playing in bands, too. I went to high school and hung out with a lot of black guys who were in rock bands, you know, they all sort of, you know, left it at one point or another. A lot of them are still musicians, but they don't necessarily play in rock bands. Yeah. They all grew up.
Was it a social group? Was it the punk rock kids in high school?
Nah, it wasn't a scene like that. It was just, you know, you ran into folks and you thought, oh wow, you know, this guy plays in a band too, you know? Oh yeah. What band do you play in? Oh, I play in such and such. I play in such and such. And, you know, you might see them around, and you know, later, you know, when people started actually going out and playing shows, you might do a show with them or something like that, where, you know, or they would come out and you'd see though, like that, well, that guy really isn't a band, here he is with his band. There was a lot
positive.
Of that. Yeah, there was a lot of that. It's like, oh, he wasn't lying, he really wasn't a punk rock band.
what was it for you, Mick, that first attracted you to punk rock?
It's tough to say, because what really, it was radio, actually. Now, to be totally honest, it was radio. I discovered the local like punk rock new wave radio show, and told all of my friends, you know, and we all, you know, got heavily into new wave.
Were you in 80, 81. Were you already playing music at the time?
Not really. I was buying a lot of records, but I wasn't really playing. It wasn't until, you know, later that we thought we could do that too. You know, that was the, it was just really just the thinking that, oh, we can do this too. You know, these guys aren't, you know, we know that they're, that stuff's pretty rudimentary. We can play that. And so it just it was snowballed from there.
What was your first professional band?
The first professional one really was the Gorries. That was the first one where we, like, we would play shows and actually get money.
Put out records.
Yeah. Put out records and things. I played in other bands. I played in a band called the U-Boats that made some recordings and never did anything. Not to be confused with the U-Boats from Cleveland who did make a record. That's not me. That wasn't the band I was in. And then, you know, I mean, every town at the time apparently had a band called the U-Boats, and every city had a really terrible punk rock band of 14-year-olds called Toxic Shock Syndrome. I was in one of those too. So, but really the Gorries was really where, you know, everything came together in such a manner where we were, you know, we were playing regularly and eventually did recordings.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted the Gorries to be? Like, did you have a, you know, obviously you didn't have a manifesto, but did you have a,
Totally.
What was it?
We had, you know, what started us was myself and Dan Croha, who was also in the Gorries. We used to get a lot of magazines like indie garage rock and mod magazine stuff. We were both mods, and we would be hearing about these bands, they'd talk in the magazines about how wild and primitive these bands were. We'd be like, oh, this has got to be awesome. And one of us would buy the record and be like, this is a little weak. This isn't wild and primitive at all. It's a bunch of jangly 12 string stuff. So we decided at some point, you know, we should form a band and we really do it as primitively as possible. We'll make it really raw, really primitive, you know. And one day we were sitting around drinking beer and we actually did it. And that's how the Gorries formed. We talked about it for probably a good year and a half before we actually took the plunge and bought gear.
But so, like, in that regard, though, too, like, you kind of say that you didn't have a manifesto, but at the same time, you went at it.
We had an idea.
Well, yeah, you weren't going to have any snare drum or cymbals or kick drum on it. It was just going to be primitive, like
exactly.
Bo Diddley style kind of tribal drums.
Just a regular, yeah,
and
primal
you gonna,
fud.
And you weren't going to have a bass either.
Well, we were. I was going to play it. We started out with me playing bass, but at the time, Danny couldn't play guitar all that well, and he was terrible on solos, but I had a knack for doing single note playing. And eventually what we would do is, if a song had lots of chords, Danny would play and I would play bass, and if it had a lot of single note stuff, we'd switch and he would play bass and I would play guitar. And then we decided we were lazy, let's just ditch the bass and we won't use it. So we just played guitar.
Ben, you're sort of betraying your Gorries nerd status. I read that
totally.
You already mentioned that there's about a 20-year age difference between the two of you, but I read somewhere that the Gorries were your all-time favorite band.
Yeah, by far.
Why was that?
I think a lot of it has to do with kind of knowing where they came from in terms of Detroit in the mid-80s and kind of having a vague memory of that. I was never aware enough or cool enough to have seen any of their performances.
You would have been six.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. I wasn't that cool when I was six. But it seems like, for me, it's just for a city like Detroit that's so diverse in its musical history and past and what it's given to, you know, Western culture in that regard, the Gorries kind of seem to encapsulate all the best stuff of Detroit music. You know, you have the John Lee Hooker style 1940s fortune blues stuff. You have the the influence of Berry Gordy and Motown and all these soul labels that were popping up in storefronts. And then you have the 1960s garage rock bands like the Kegs or the Unrelated Segments or, you know, anyone on Back from the Grave, all kind of filtered through this, you know, these three people who couldn't have been on the surface more different. And the way it all came together and the way it hits you on the records and everything is just it's just uncomparable to anything else. And you just have certain moments. I just remember, like, driving down the freeway in Detroit and putting on a Gorries record, listening to it in the car. And you just have these moments of just, I don't know how else to describe it other than, like, pure consciousness. We're just like, this totally makes sense. It is completely perfect. There's nothing wrong with this. I mean, it's almost as if it was spit out by a computer program in terms of something being completely perfect. I mean, that's how the Gories hit me, and that's how it affects me. And now I just sit in a van with the guy from the Gories, and we just, you know, smell each other's BO for 12 hours at a time.
Yeah, what do you think about all this, Mick?
Oh, I'm used to it now. No, it never really comes up. You know? It doesn't really come up.
Well, it came up yesterday. You're totally lying. We're sitting on the couch, and I'm plucking away. I'm doing playing this guitar part for a song called Yaha Bibi by this band, the Belairs, who was a garage band from Grand Rapids, Michigan, 1966. They have a song the song Yaha Bibi was comped on this Back from the Grave comp, but the Gories covered it. So I'm just sitting there like plucking it out in the acoustic guitar. And Mick from across the room is like,
"Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Oh, I'm gonna have to rehearse that song because the Gories have covered it and they're gonna be doing some shows."
Yeah, I'd forgotten all about that one. That was one of the really tough ones to play.
And I just said to him, "I was like, don't worry, Mick, I'll teach it to you."
The Gories lasted for a few years, but weren't permanent. You had all these other projects going on, Mick. What initially was the germ of the Dirt Bombs? What led you to create the band?
It was just going to be another in a series of bands, you know, like another band that I was doing among, you know, a band among bands that had a limited. I had my original specification sheet, which I actually wrote out while the Gories were on tour in Germany. I wrote out like a spec sheet of what the Dirt Bombs were going to do, you know, what kind of music is going to play and what the lineup was going to be. And I even had like notes on people sort of thing.
That's really like eighth grade.
I know, that description. I know.
You also drop little logos.
No, I didn't do any of that. But yeah, it was like, you know, I was sitting there bored and it was going to be another band. And then
make up possible names for yourself in the band.
Nicknames.
You're right, little nicknames.
Mrs. Mick Dirtbomb.
And then when I got home, I just, you know, set about doing it. You know, at the time, by the time the Gories got home from that tour, we realized that the split was going to be permanent, you know, but it really wasn't, you know, the Dirtbombs wasn't the next thing. It was just another thing I was doing.
What made it into the next thing? Because it did become the next thing to a certain extent.
Right. Yeah, it is now basically the main thing, although I did cut four albums in between, you know, in between the first couple of Dirtbombs recordings and the next one, I went off and did some other things. The Dirtbombs was basically a good excuse to make money to go to comic book conventions, which is why the only reason it stuck around was like, oh, this is great. We go on tour for about 3 weeks and I have enough money to go to comic book conventions. This is awesome. And then at some point, the crowd started getting bigger and, you know, the record, we put out a record and it would be like, and suddenly I thought, oh, maybe I should keep doing this.
It's the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org. We'll have more with Mick Collins and Ben Blackwell of the Dirt Bombs in just a minute.
Production of the Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
If you're the kind of person who saves all their charitable giving to the very, very, very end of the year and then does it all in one fell swoop, I want you to know that we're more than happy to accept your donation right here at MaximumFun.org. If you'd like to give a year-end gift to support the Sound of Young America, Jordan, Jesse, Go, Coyle and Sharp, Casper Hauser, our blog, our forums, and everything else that we do, you can just visit MaximumFun.org and then click on Donate in the upper right-hand corner. If you prefer not to use PayPal, you can also send us a check. The address is on that donate page. To all of you who already do donate to support the Sound of Young America, my heartfelt thanks, and here's to another great year. Welcome back to the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are Mick Collins and Ben Blackwell of the Detroit band The Dirt Bombs. Their new album is called We Have You Surrounded. You put out this record called Ultra Glide in Black in 2001, right? Is that right? Mm-hmm. Do I have the date right?
Yes.
That was a time when the music press was obsessed with the idea of Detroit garage rock.
Yeah.
And that album, that album both fit into that narrative exceptionally well and didn't fit into that narrative exceptionally
perfect
well.
Perfect way to put it.
Yes, it is.
It was a collection of soul and R&B covers. What led you to conceive that, Mick? Was it part of the original plan?
Yeah, it was. It was on the list on the spec sheet. Well, okay, what happened was when we did the first album, which was Horn Dog Fest from 1997, I didn't want to actually make any full-length LPs with the Dirt Bombs. That wasn't the idea. The idea was the Dirt Bombs were going to make 15 four-song 7-inches, and then that was going to be the end of the project. It was a project. I got lost in argument with the guy who runs In the Red Records, who was going to put out this thing, and I called everybody I knew. It's like, hey, look, should I do this as a bunch of 7-inches, or should I make a full length? And everybody, to a man, said, make a full length.
My imagination of the argument involves you explaining like that. All of the different covers were going to go together as a mosaic of a really cool dragon.
No, it wasn't anything like that. Well, that's not a bad idea. It wasn't anything like that. It was just, you know, and then suddenly I thought, well, after I lost this argument, I thought, okay, well, if everybody wants to make full lengths, I've got to do something to make it interesting. I have a really short attention span, right? My attention span lasts about the length of a full-length LP. And that's about all I'm willing to listen to. So, like, double albums, it's going to take me like a week to sit through a two-record set. Because I just, after the first album, I feel like I'm done with it. So after I lost this argument, we did the first full length. I thought, well, I've got to do something to make this interesting for me to record. And I thought, well, if I stick to one idea for the entire album, that'll be interesting. I can work inside that, and that'll make it interesting. So I made a list of like, okay, what are the things that I would like to do? Like if I were a person, you know, if I wasn't in this band, what would I want to hear this band do? And one of them was an album of the songs that I found inspiring or memorable from my childhood, and that's how that happened. And it was there was an order too to the list had the which you know what number the record was going to be, and Ultra Glide in Black was originally the fourth one on the list, and then I was at a friend's house and he played me Ode to a Black Man by Phil Lynott, and I thought, I've got to record that before someone beats me to it. So I changed the order around so that Ultra Glide would be the second LP. And it was just, you know, the songs on the record, except for two, one I wrote and one that was supposed to be a B-side, except for two, they were all songs that I really, really liked as a kid. These were records that, you know, I had as a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, 7-year-old, and I constantly played them. You know, and records, and some of them, you know, a couple of them were, well, they weren't on, and I didn't play them that much. I thought they were representative of music I liked as a kid. So that was the whole point of Ultra Glide. I guess Bowie's Pinups is an example of that. You know, that's sort of what it could be compared to.
Did you at all notice, like, after we recorded it and after all that stuff, there was kind of, in more than a handful of songs, though, the kind of lyrical subject matter is kind of the black experience, though? I mean, was that intentional, or did you... I mean, when you think of songs like Ode to a Black Man or Kung Fu or Natural Man, they're kind of this undertone, or Living for the City, there's kind of this right. undertone of, like, the
social
black
consciousness.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it wasn't intentional, but so many of the songs from that era are all heavily socially conscious. One of the other things about that record was I always felt that those songs were rock songs already. You know, I didn't feel like I was doing anything really different. They were all, especially like Sly Stone, and those songs are already rock and roll songs, really. They just happen to be written by black authors. And when the record came out, it was really, really frustrating to hear people call it an R&B record, because I wasn't making an R&B record. I was making a rock album. Black people understood immediately that it was a rock and roll record, but nobody else seemed to get the idea.
Now,
Ben is always asking me why I feel that record such an album. That's one of them. That's one of the problems I have with it, is that everybody keeps calling it a soul record, and there was no intention of making a soul record.
Well, people were calling
record.
It, I mean, just because of the time it came out, though, too, people were calling it a garage record.
Yeah, and that too.
Well, and your thing was, I was doing garage records 10 years ago. This is so far from what you would personally consider a garage record.
Yeah, my definition of garage rock differs from the current one, apparently.
Can you let me ask you this question. Can you imagine yourself making a soul record or making an R&B record?
I would do it. You know, I wouldn't be against it. I would do it, but it wouldn't, you know, I don't think it would be what people expected. I actually had an idea, had an idea to do it, to make one. I would still like to, maybe. I'm not sure if I, you know, I'd do it. Yeah, I cut a funk album. Why wouldn't I? I mean, why wouldn't I? I cut a funk album. We're going to cut another one.
As long as it would have a complicated format, like
it's all 3-inch CDs.
Maybe you could put it out on wax cylinder.
Right, right.
Yes,
it's 12 wax cylinders that you line up.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I'm not. I record anything. There's, for me, you know, my reward for the recording and all that is about to go away, actually. It's actually seeing the physical record, like walking into a store and seeing my record. That's the payoff for me, you know, for all of it. That's the part I like. That was one of the things that kept me making records, was being able to see the records. And these days, you know, that's a less and less of an option.
Both of you guys seem to be very passionate about records as consumers as well as producers. Do you think that has any kind of effect on the music that you make?
Only in the production of it, I think, because we still mix, like when I'm making a record, I still mix for vinyl. You know, I mix with the end result being an LP or a 7-inch. I don't mix with the end result being a CD or an audio file. That's really, for me, that's really the only place it comes into play at.
What about for you, Ben?
I think, I mean, as a record buyer, you can't take that mask off and not have that in your mind when you're making records. But in terms of making them, you know, I put out records as a label. I run a label in Detroit, and part of it, like I think a lot of my inspiration in doing that was just I saw how other people were doing it and what I didn't like about it. It was kind of more of a negative influence. And so I said, well, this is how I want to do things. I want to do things that are quick and, you know, kind of special of the moment, you know. So the past couple tours, the Dirt Bombs have done, we've done like a tour single, which you only sell at our merch table and have a song that's only on there with, you know, the bands we're on tour with will be on the B side, and just rubber stamp the labels, you know, very handmade DIY kind of approach. And it can be very, very quick thing. Whereas, you know, other things you see a really big, and it's not that I'm against something that's elaborate or big or grandiose, but it's just like, I don't, like Mick said, I think we have short attention spans, and like all the work that goes into that, you know, by the time you're working on the, you know, the artwork for the second gatefold of your LP, it's just like, you know, I want to be on something else, you know, like just give me something that can be quick.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guests are Mick Collins and Ben Blackwell of the band The Dirt Bombs. On this new album, We Have You Surrounded, it feels like it's you mentioned Living for the City earlier. It has that same tone. So many of the songs have that urban closeness and nervousness. That kind of city feeling was that intended going in?
Yeah, that became the dominant theme of the record. We were cutting a five song. We were making a five song EP originally, and I got a phone call from the label. And while I was talking with the guy, it came, you know, it popped up that it had been 4 years since the last Dirt Bombs album. I thought, oh, I better get on that then. So we had just done two or three songs, and they all had the same theme of, you know, living in the city and, you know, sort of, you know, decaying city and, you know, things getting out of control. And I thought, well, that's the new record then. We'll just make every song about that. And even though that wasn't, you know, that was sort of the general idea. Some of the songs start out being about other things, and they became that over the course of recording.
Is there a particular song that really that speaks powerfully to that theme on this record that you'd like to sort of highlight?
When we first got the finished version of our album back, now it seems like over a year ago, Mick and I were driving in a car back. We'd played a show in New York, and we put in the CD, and we listened to the song Ever Loving Man. And as it finished, as it faded out, Mick kind of turned the stereo down and just kind of said to me, matter-of-factly, he's like, I don't think there will ever be a better Dirt Bomb song than this. And I just looked at him like, yeah, you're right.
Time is running out, and I can't wait. I have to say this before it's too late. I want to be the one to hear you call, to catch you as you tumble while the empire falls. And when I say it out loud, I look like it's the meal.
You guys have a song on this record, the lyrics of which it came from a comic book.
Yes.
Tell me, you're the comic book enthusiast, Mitch.
Yeah.
Tell me about how that came about.
Enthusiast is putting it nicely. We usually just say nerd, but
okay.
All right. Probably around 2005, I had picked up a comic book by the writer Alan Moore, who is responsible for From Hell and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and the Watchmen and some other things.
V for Vendetta,
right. And he had published a book of poems and song lyrics that he had written. And Leopard Man from CNA was in this comic because he occasionally does a band with David Jay from Bauhaus. He occasionally has a band, and I saw these lyrics. I thought, well, that would make a good Dirt Bomb song if I could find the record. I'll just cover it, you know. And so, off and on over the intervening couple of years there, I made inquiries trying to find this song, and no one seemed to have any knowledge of this song, you know. And so I got more and more intent about it, and it got to the point where, you know, I would do a web search on this song, and the only things that would come up were people asking about it on my behalf. So finally it transpires that there is no recording of the song. They never, he wrote it for another one of their records, and they never recorded it. And I thought, well, heck, I'll just write my own music to these lyrics. And that's how Leopard Man at CNA happened.
I think while we were in the studio doing it, it was vaguely kind of conveyed that this wasn't, at least the lyrics weren't mixed or whatever. But I, you know, for me, it's like, you show up, you record a couple songs, and then 6 months later, you get handed a finished CD. And you're like, wow, I played on this? But when I found out that Mick kind of tailored the song, not kind of tailored, but really just he put all this music around the words, I was really amazed because it sounds so ingrained together. I can't imagine that they're two separate parts of this song. So good job, Mick.
Well, thank you. I was actually pretty pleased myself when we finished it.
You guys are on a pretty big tour right now. You're here in Los Angeles on tour. What's that like for you to be the opening act in a gargantuan rock and roll-a-thon as opposed to being in that situation you described, Mick, of being the only band in town sometimes in Detroit, the one thing to do that week.
Yeah, we've done both. This tour for us started in the middle of February of 2008, and we're still on it. It will apparently end in the middle of December of this year. So we've done every show from little tiny bars in the middle of nowhere to, you know, like now, right now we're opening with opening for TV on the Radio, and they're playing like gigantic theaters, and we played festivals. You know, we played every conceivable venue that a band could play. Well, the we've all done it all in the 1 year.
Yeah. Well, the weird thing about opening for TV on the Radio too is that it not being our own headlining show is we kind of constrict the set. You know, yeah. We kind of cut off the fat and you know, try to have almost no time in between songs, just one after another. For
right.
Train
because
style.
Because we know the audience really isn't there to see us, so we just we get up there, we play a set. You know, like get them in, you know, kind of hopefully at the end of our set, they're ready to rock out to TV on the Radio.
but the interesting thing, too, is that in that we're opening for this band who's huge, whose album was, you know, Billboard Top 20, it debuted and all this stuff, is that opening for them still becomes kind of like the only thing happening in town. Yeah. Like you're still, you know, the big event that everyone's looking forward right. to. And it's not necessarily because of us, but we're still a part of it. But their fans, the band themselves, those guys at TV on the Radio, are amazing and wonderful and just like a dream come true touring with them. And the fans too. Yeah. I think we've won over more than our fair share. I think we've
done really well with them. Yeah.
We've pulled a lot of tricks though. I mean we had to
yeah, sure. You know. It's always the way. And you're gonna go on rock and roll tour.
Yeah.
It also strikes me as kind of landmark in the world of black rock, with TV on the Radio being a predominantly African American band. Have you, Mick, gotten reactions to your show that are different, given that you're in this context of two rock bands that have black members?
Not really. Not you know. And now that you say that, it is kind of odd that it hasn't actually been mentioned. But no one said anything about it, really.
That's interesting to me because, you know, a lot of black folks who I know who are into rock and roll are very aware of it because, you know, a lot of times you go to a show and you're mm-hmm. the black guy there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. There have been many, many shows where I'm the only black dude in the whole building. And once we played more than our fair share of shows where I walked in and the club thought I was the roadie.
Well, another interesting thing, though, too, is that earlier this year, we played a festival in Brooklyn called the Afropunk Festival that is kind of based around this idea of, you know, black people punks. In rock bands. Yeah. And after the show, we did an interview, an on-camera interview, and they said, oh, you know, Dirt Bombs, thanks for coming. Mick Collins, you know, thank you so much. What made you decide to play the Afropunk Festival? And Mick said...
the check.
Which was kind of weird because in their eyes it's the Afropunk is a documentary movie that they did. It's this festival. It's they call it the
yeah,
move.
It's a, for
they
them go, it's a movement. It's a movement. Mindset. And I'm just like I'm just a dude in a band. You know, you know it wasn't there was I wasn't making you know I'm not making any sort of political statement by being a black guy playing rock music. I'm just a guy in a band.
What was their reaction to that?
I think we were hustled out of there.
Yeah,
real
I think
fast.
They were kind of. I think they were kind of bummed that we didn't have like some larger social agenda about
yeah,
it or
yeah.
whatever. Just like you know what was the? We didn't come there with some bigger aspirations.
Yeah.
It was just like we're a rock band. We're yeah. we're not delusional about what
to
that
expect
means.
From being a rock band. Exactly.
You know, the guy who directed Afropunk was on The Sound of Young America when Afropunk first came out. It was quite some time ago now, 5 years ago. Super nice guy. And I interviewed him, my then co-host Jordan and I interviewed him standing at the base of the UC Santa Cruz campus in our underwear for a pledge drive stunt. He's
all
got
right.
like, you know, at the time I think he had a giant mohawk and stuff. And
that's what wearing, I call radio.
And he was exceedingly gracious. So I can't imagine that he was that fazed by your answer, Mick.
I mean, I kind of said it humorously, but really that was, you know, I mean, I like you said, there's no broader social agenda of being in a rock band. I mean, it's what I do. And, you know, and also, as we were saying earlier, I don't just play rock, you know, I got a funk band and, you know, I have a techno project as well. So, you know, it's just a band.
Well, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to be on The Sound of Young America. It was really fun to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Jesse.
Mick Collins and Ben Blackwell are in the rock and roll band The Dirt Bombs. Their new album is called We Have You Surrounded. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music written and performed by Dan Grayson with help from myself. Interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. This show edited by Nick White. Our intern is Casey O'Brien. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org. where you'll find our blog, among other things. And if you want to follow us, both me and Jordan are on the Twitter. My username is Young American. Jordan's is Jordan_Morris. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we'll see you next time on The Sound of Young America.
This message comes from Schwab. It's easy to invest in ideas you believe in with Schwab investing themes, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, and electric vehicles. Choose from over 40 customizable themes. More at schwab.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
That's the voice of Miss Gloria Jones, the original artist behind the song Tainted Love. But I don't think she's ever gotten the credit she deserves.
I could not agree more. So let's shed some light on the untold story of Tainted Love.
On Lost Notes from KCRW, part of the NPR Podcast Network.